ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
He's probably the most influential architect of the past 50 years, Lord Norman Foster, who recently turned 90. He's designed Apple stores, its circular headquarters in California, the Reichstag building in Berlin, Wembley Stadium, the so-called Gherkin Tower in the City of London. Currently, there's an exhibition of his work in Sydney, Civic Vision. And this week, I'm delighted to say, I caught up with him when he was visiting Seoul in South Korea. Lord Foster, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Very good.
One of the reasons we're speaking to you today is because there's an exhibition of your work at the building in Sydney, which houses the Gadigal Metro Station. It's been very popular with critics and the public alike. I wonder what the formula is in your mind for a successful building that hits that sweet spot, critical acclaim and public acclamation.
It's a combination of things. I suppose that if you take the metro, then if the metro guides you to your destination and you don't have to think too much, it's more intuitive, then you're going to feel more reassured. Really, it comes down to the core issue that everything is design. And if it's well designed, then it makes you feel good. It improves the quality of your life, and you don't really think about it. Now, of course, it's a sliding scale. You can create those spaces where you enter and you think, wow. I mean, it is the cliche, the wow factor, which is perhaps more the element of surprise. And if you think of buildings like, say, the Guggenheim in New York, you go through a low space and then you explode into that dynamic space. So it is the control of space, and sometimes the movement through something which is quite intimate into something which is grander in scale. So it's really a fusion of the function and the desire to make something beautiful. So something that works in the material world and something that also works in the spiritual world.
I've heard you say that it's not just function, it is not just form, that feel is just as important.
Yes, I mean, we do have an emotional relationship with nature. If we're aware of the changing of the seasons, I mean, right now here in Seoul, it's autumn. You know, the leaves are turning and you are aware of it. And people are talking about it over dinner. You know, it's beautiful colors outside. So it is a relationship with nature, the magic of a view. We know, for example, that a patient that's had surgery and recovers in a room with a view will leave hospital earlier than somebody who doesn't have a view, will use less painkillers. So all of this has been quantified. Of course, those of us as designers, perhaps in the past, going back to the 60s or 70s, we believe passionately that if you had that contact with nature, natural light, natural ventilation, a glimpse of a view, that it would be good for you. Now we know scientifically that it really is.
I want to take you back to your childhood and the views that you were looking out upon in your childhood. You are now a lord, you are now a knight, two of the highest honours that Britain can bestow. But you come from a working class background in Manchester. You grew up in a terraced house. I wonder how that upbringing shaped you as a designer.
I think we're all products of our background and influences. And obviously parental influences, a work ethic, a sense of values. I think those cut across really all levels of society. But growing up, like many of my generation, I had construction sets. I was fascinated by locomotives. I happened to live adjacent to a railway line. So cars, automobiles, buildings, before I really ever discovered architecture as a profession, I had a real enjoyment of buildings. I mean, my first experience of a building was Manchester Town Hall as a work of architecture, because I left school at 16 and worked as an office boy in the town hall. And I still have very vivid memories of that. But I didn't think at the time this was great architecture. But I certainly was aware of the details of the feeling of that place. And it certainly moved me emotionally.
It's an industrial landscape that we associate with the art of L.S. Lowry, a painter famed for his matchstick men and women and matchstick cats and dogs. And I understand you own one of his works now. It's a heritage that you clearly hold dear.
Well, my wife bought me an early Lowry as a birthday present, as a reminder of my of Lowry really being a favorite artist when I was growing up. But I never, ever thought at the time that I might be privileged to own a Lowry. So that's, yes, it's a very nice connection. Lowry, still the paintings I find extraordinary, the way in which they capture that gritty urbanity of the industrial north.
You said there that you left school at 16. You did not have the qualifications to go to university, and yet you made it to university. You studied architecture at Manchester University in your hometown. I wondered how you made that transition from the kid who left school at 16 to the guy that managed to get a qualification in architecture.
Well, I left school at 16. I was 2 years in Manchester Town Hall, and then I did 2 years national service, which was compulsory at that time. And I was a radar technician, which was the kind of hot science of that time. And then in the year after that, not returning to the town hall, I discovered architecture as a profession. Slightly complicated story, but having discovered that you could go to a school of architecture, in Manchester, there were two schools. There was the art school, which was funded by the Manchester Education Authority, and there was the university. I didn't have the qualifications for a university, but I applied nonetheless, and they made a great exception. They allowed me to do the degree course, but because I didn't have the qualifications for a degree, I got the same piece of paper at the end of 5 years, but instead of saying degree, it said diploma. So there was a very nice twist there.
You won a claim as a young architect in the UK for some buildings that really pushed the boundaries in some fairly unfashionable places. An insurance office in Ipswich with curved glass walls and a roof garden that was very novel at the time. A Renault car centre in Swindon, of all places, which you could actually mistake for an art gallery. But the building that established your international reputation was in Hong Kong, the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, a very distinctive design, making a virtue again of structural elements. Do you look back on that landmark building as the scheme that turned you from a British architect into a global architect?
It's interesting that Bob Stern, who was the dean of the Yale School of Architecture, suggested that the genesis of the Hong Kong building was a project that I did as a student at Yale, where I broke through a number of kind of prejudices and suggested that I worked with an engineer. And so the Hong Kong Bank was revolutionary in the way that it took out the central core. So all high-rise buildings before Hong Kong Bank was a ribbon of space around a central core of structure and services. Hong Kong Bank kind of took those and put them on the side of open loft spaces. So for the first time, you could see through such a building. And interestingly, it became perhaps the first headquarters that was able, as a tall building, to take a dealer's floor. Because, of course, for a dealer, you need a line of sight. So each of these buildings that we're describing, they all pushed the boundaries to do something which was different, not different for the sake of being different, but different in terms of offering a better quality of life, a better lifestyle.
Another building which really enhanced your reputation was the Reichstag building in Berlin. It opened in 1999. It was another hit and something of a new departure. There was a blend of the modern, a stunning new dome, and also the historic, the old Parliament building. How did you balance those elements to pull off that marriage?
The dome element was triggered by a movement to bring back a replica of the historic, original 19th century dome, which was a symbol of an authoritarian regime. And under pressure to do such a thing, and I remember at the time saying that there was no way that we were ever going to replicate a historic dome from the past. And that triggered the idea of a dome that would be a symbol of democracy in action. And it became part of a holistic ecological design that produced effectively a zero carbon public building. But that also came out of the interview process in terms of suggesting that the politicians should have the opportunity to set an example to the nation at large by effectively doing a zero carbon building. Now, the whole idea of sustainability is something that we had been and have continually been pushing since the birth of the practice in the 1960s. But the Reichstag was a public demonstration of that manifesto, a green manifesto, as it later became known. So really the ecological, sustainable story, the idea of inviting the public and that the public being symbolically above the politicians who were answerable to them. Of course, all of this had to be agreed with politicians who had been trained to disagree with each other and to challenge each other. So finding consensus was quite an experience.
You're listening to ABC Saturday Extra with me, Nick Bryan, and I'm interviewing Lord Foster, probably the world's most famous and celebrated architect. Lord Foster, you are known for the design of your Apple store, that sleek design aesthetic, and also Apple's headquarters in Cupertino in California, which brought about a collaboration with the great tech innovator of our age, Steve Jobs. I wonder what it was like to work with him.
Well, after he sadly passed away, I had the task of communicating that vision which he created. The opening image I showed was his portrait, and next to it, a quote, "Don't think of me as your client, think of me as a member of the team." That perhaps sums up the spirit of the project. I mean, it was a call out of the blue saying, "Hi, Norman, I'm here in Cupertino. I need some help. How quickly can you get here?" And two or three weeks later, we were together in the meeting room. We were together in a car going across the freeways, ending up in the kitchen with the family with pizza. And that was really the birth of the project and a working relationship that was quite extraordinary. And the language, perhaps, of that building is encapsulated in the stores.
And I've read that at one point in the process of designing the Apple campus, you were struggling to get where you wanted to get to. And Steve Jobs said something which I was struck by. He said that every project needs a crisis moment.
Well, I think that the building as a circle looks like it was almost a kind of one-liner, because there is a seeming inevitability about it. But perhaps to explain that phrase, it was a struggle over some 9 or 10 months of design development when we were struggling to resolve the integration of his ideal pod. You're really working hard to resolve how a building works internally and what its expression is externally. And so if you can imagine all these different curvilinear shapes of buildings evolving over this 8 or 9 month period, and then late in that period, there's the moment where you're absolutely desperate, and then suddenly you have that accumulated knowledge, and presto, you realize that the circular building will do the trick. And it was that kind of fulfillment, resolution of the crisis, because at that point, as a designer, you've accumulated a lot of knowledge about the site, about the inner workings of Apple, the demands of their programmers, and then Eureka. It suddenly seems so obvious and so simple. But I use the analogy of an iceberg. You see the tip of an iceberg, it's the built building, it's the physicality. What you do not see is the vast amount that lies below the surface. Call it the process, the struggle.
Let's talk about your latest project in America. You've just designed the new JP Morgan Chase Tower in New York, a new addition to the world's most famous skyline. The Wall Street Journal has called it a thrilling addition. I wonder whether you feel an extra sense of responsibility when you are adding to such a famous and much-loved cityscape.
Well, I think there's another even deeper dimension to it, and that is that the building that it replaced was quite a modern classic of its period. But events have overtaken that period. So the demands of today are different from those in the 1950s. You need more ceiling height. You need more service space. You have the incorporation of much more advanced technology. You have greater awareness of the implications of energy consumption, different perception of the workplace in terms of the facilities that it needs to incorporate. But what we were able to achieve by the design, by the cantilevers, so this building comes down on a fan-like structure. So although we increase the density by twice, so there are twice the number of people, it's twice as high, but it is delivering at the ground level something like 2.5 times more public space at the base than the previous building. And we have to remember that a city which is dense and walkable, like New York, which is a high-rise version, but we could be talking about a city like London or Paris, those cities which are dense and walkable, their carbon footprint is half that of the sprawling car-borne city. So a number of factors, the fact that Manhattan itself, by virtue of its public transport, its density, is a sustainable model. And then the JP Morgan skyscraper is powered by hydroelectricity, and in that sense is operationally virtually zero carbon.
I know you're a great fan of the Chrysler Building. It's certainly my favorite skyscraper in New York. I was in New York recently, and I was worried that the Chrysler Building was getting slightly crowded out. And some people have said the same thing is happening in the City of London, and it's crowding out one of your famous skyscrapers, the Gherkin. Is there a danger that our cityscapes are becoming too congested?
Probably over the centuries, there's been similar phrases at various points in time as cities have become more developed. So those buildings that hopefully are extraordinary historic symbols of their time are protected. But the city itself is organic. It's always evolving. It's always responding to change. In that sense, I think that the Chrysler Building at the time, and I recall using images of it when it was really very much on its own in the 30s. But I think that relationship is different, but it's still a wonderful masterpiece of its time. And I perhaps argue that a city that has buildings from different periods in the past, in the end, is richer by that juxtaposition.
Lord Foster, you've spoken a lot about sustainability. I wonder whether I can raise the issue of affordability. So many cities in the world right now, whether it's New York City or Sydney or London, have this affordability problem. I wonder what role architecture can play in solving that.
It's a very, very valid question. And the foundation, the Norman Foster Foundation, which is headquartered in Madrid, has been working with industry at different levels to demonstrate the potential of delivering an affordable housing unit in Costa Rica, where we are at scale going to be delivering a home at something like $15,000-$16,000. Now, that's very different from perhaps the kind of home in a different context. So if I think about the work that we're doing with a consortium of Portuguese industries, and we have an exhibition at the moment, the foundation showing a number of its projects. One of these is a built module, if you can imagine it as a container-like module, but showing the potential of delivering quite high-quality units, originally started with student accommodation, but it's now expanded outwards. So that potential of industrializing is arguably the only way that you're going to be able to significantly drive down costs of affordable housing.
Lord Foster, this year you celebrated your 90th birthday. I wonder whether that has made you reflect on what you think is your single biggest contribution to global architecture.
I don't think I'm the best person to judge that. I think history is, and others. I would perhaps reflect that over the decades, the quest to seek a resolution of beauty, sustainability, has really shown the potential to have a relationship with the natural world, to be able to point the way to a more sustainable future.
Just one final question. You're designing a new stadium for Manchester United, the new Old Trafford. It's a really ambitious project. How important is it for you to return to the city where you grew up and to design what will be a monumental structure?
I think it's just a great combination, because Manchester United football, the fans, the expectations, the creation of a space that will somehow capture the spectacle, the roar, all of those qualities, tangible and intangible, and in the process to regenerate an industrial quarter of Manchester, which coincidentally was where my father worked in Metropolitan Vicars in Old Trafford. So there's a kind of continuum, a completing the circle in that sense. So yes, that's very satisfying.
And for young architects out there listening to this who want to be the next Norman Foster, what's your advice?
Follow the advice that I try to follow myself, and that is to stay a student. And what do I mean by that? Well, as a student, you can challenge, you have to be a good listener, you can take risks, but above all, you should stay humble.
As a young architectural student myself, you're a great inspiration to me. Alongside my bed is still a book with your works in it. Lord Foster, it's been a great pleasure to interview you. Thanks for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Well, thank you.
And the exhibition of drawings and models from Norman Foster's practice is on in Sydney. It's in Parkline Place above the Gadigal Metro Station. It's free and on until December the 21st.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.